Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. One way the first state can address its teacher shortage is finding ways to retain the teachers schools already have.
We do not have sufficient teachers who are willing to work for the compensation that they often receive under the working conditions that they must work.
We talked to a University of Delaware professor about how the state schools can keep teachers in their classrooms. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn about a group of teachers fostering student interest in becoming math teachers and highlight a community program that engages high school students in philanthropic work. Plus, Enlighten Me examines the benefits of birding on health and well-being. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Schools and districts across the country are grappling with a shortage of teachers, struggling to recruit and retain staff. According to a recent membership survey by the Delaware State Education Association, the state's largest teachers union, 75% of Delaware teachers say they're more likely to retire or leave education earlier than planned. This week, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon sits down with Lauren Bales, associate professor in the University of Delaware's School of Education, to learn more about what's causing teachers to leave the profession and how the issue can be addressed.
We're talking about teacher retention today in Delaware. At Delaware Public Media, we've reported on the state's ongoing teacher shortage recently, and a part of that larger shortage problem lies the retention issue. So, you know, that's something that Delaware is certainly not alone in dealing with, but why is retaining teachers and keeping them in the profession an issue right now? What's going on?
I'll start with some broader context. I think this is not a problem unique to Delaware or a challenge unique to Delaware. Certainly, we see that teacher retention has been an issue nationwide for many decades, especially in some hard-to-staff areas like STEM or languages or mathematics. What we're seeing more recently are the results of some budget constraints and cutbacks that actually happened after the Great Recession, and then were further exacerbated during and after the COVID-19 pandemic. And so we have a couple of challenges here. I think one is we actually do, according to a recent report by the Economic Policy Institute, have sufficient qualified and licensed teachers in the country to staff the positions that we have vacant. The challenge is we do not have sufficient teachers who are willing to work for the compensation that they often receive under the working conditions that they must work. And that includes the workload itself, the variety of tasks and the demand of those tasks. It also includes the stress and mental health implications of working in that job. So those are two kind of driving challenges associated with retention.
Well, we spoke about this off air before getting started, but you've also studied patterns in teacher retention. So what have you found there?
Sure. So the research that I've done in this area in particular is about what we call alternative licensure. So we can generally think about teacher preparation and licensure in kind of two big categories. One is a traditional four-year university-based preparation and licensure, what we call traditional license or traditional certification. And the other is a very broad category called alternative certification. And these can be things like grow your own pathways. They can be things when schools and districts or state education associations license and place their own teachers. And so my research looks at how those two sets of preparation are different. What I found with my co-author, Sarah Guthrie, is that when you have an alternatively licensed teacher, they experience a different retention likelihood than a traditionally based teacher. And so our research didn't allow us to name kind of causal mechanisms for this, but what we were able to see is that likelihood is really exacerbated when they're placed into a charter school as their first placement. So we hypothesized a couple of things around this. One, we thought that perhaps if you are a person who's going into a traditional four-year university-based preparation program, you've probably thought about this career choice quite a bit. Like, this is probably something you're committed to, you want to do. Maybe like both of us, you have educators in your family, and so you have this sort of legacy understanding of the profession. And if you go into a traditional public school as your first placement, you are actually likely to remain in the profession. So you hit that 5-year benchmark that we have come to understand as kind of a threshold of longevity among novice teachers. If, on the other hand, you are an alternatively licensed teacher, you are less likely to remain in the classroom and in the profession. And that likelihood decreases even further when you're placed into a charter school. Now, importantly, these data are from Texas. There are different policies that govern alternative licensure across states and charter schools across states. But I think there's maybe one or two lessons from this. And one is when we think about the kind of preparation that traditional teachers get, there might be something unique and valuable about that that connects them to the profession in a way that's durable. And I think the other one is when we think about charter schools in particular, other kinds of choice options, we want to make sure that teachers are really getting the support that they need and deserve, especially in those critical early years in the profession.
You also, we touched on the wages here, compensation, and that can vary greatly in Delaware, depending, let alone any other state, but that can vary greatly in Delaware depending on where you teach. What about that? Can you unpack that just a little bit more for us?
Yeah, so I think one thing that's really promising in Delaware is we are growing teacher wages by quite a bit. And so by 2028, teacher wages will be at $60,000. And there are other staff and school faculty positions that are also going to grow in wages during that same time. So I think we are becoming very competitive in terms of teacher wage. Now, the challenge is teacher wages as a profession have not kept up with other professions associated with college education. I think that's one challenge. Another one is if you look at public sector wages relative to private sector wages, especially in the post-pandemic era, those private sector wages have recovered and actually bounced back much more quickly and aggressively than public sector wages. So that has, wooed some people away from public sector occupations like teaching. So we have some compression in teacher wages, even when you're rapidly enhancing the kind of base salary level.
Well, we've spoken a lot today about the issue itself and what's causing it, the factors and so on. But what's the downside here? What kind of impact do high rates of educator turnover have on things like student learning and the stability of like schools and districts? What exactly is that downside, that impact of a lack thereof teacher retention?
Unfortunately, it affects almost every aspect of school function. And so I think one thing is it's incredibly expensive to replace a teacher. So depending on the kind of district, it can cost between $9,000 and $20,000 to replace just one teacher. And so you imagine the kind of person power, the hours that that takes up, and the resources that search, retention, placement, training process might take away from other often critical needs in the organization. A second one is related to what you mentioned, and we think about instructional continuity, right? Just is teaching consistent across an organization? And when you have a high degree of teacher turnover, the answer is probably no. And that takes away from student learning. It can be highly associated with things like attendance and absenteeism. And then you have challenges related to the quality of teachers and the distribution of teachers. And what we tend to find is that the most novice teachers, who are still learning how to do the work of the profession, might be in places that have really high needs, that have really constrained resources. And so they need to be doing their best work all the time, even though they're still learning how to do the work of the profession. And so we see these distribution challenges where you're more veteran, more experienced, maybe more effective teachers are going to wealthier districts. They're probably going to districts with a higher proportion of white students. And you see your more novice, maybe more ineffective teachers just by virtue of less experience going to places where there's already resource constraints. There might already be high levels of teacher turnover. And so you have this sorting effect between effective teachers and not effective teachers, often driven by turnover.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that piece up to the veteran teachers, where those in large part might be the ones mostly leaving and the impact that can have. They're veterans, but at those schools, they mean a whole lot as far as being a staple, not only to a grade they might teach in, but to the entire school in general. So you can imagine when, you know, that person, that kind of rock isn't there anymore, not only for the staff, but the students. Let's unpack some solutions here to teacher retention in Delaware then. What are some ways we can improve teacher retention rates beyond maybe the wage issue we covered?
Absolutely. And I think that there's some good news here in that the wage issue is important, but it's not the number one driver of teacher mobility. So even if you look at Delaware's mobility survey, which is a questionnaire that teachers do when they move, it's sent to them by the Department of Education, the number one driver of mobility is school leadership. And so what this suggests to me is that when teachers are making the decision to move, they're thinking about the kinds of supports they're receiving, the quality of the leader in the school, and the climate and working conditions that they're dealing with day in and day out. And so there's this adage in teacher turnover conversations that teachers aren't leaving students, they're leaving schools and leaders. And I think we see that particularly in these kind of data that suggest leaders have a lot to do with it. I think one solution is equipping leaders to manage organizations effectively, to create climates of trust and support and provide teachers with healthy and mentally sound working conditions. So giving them what they need, thinking about what that means in terms of the demand on their time and task, and also doing that connective work between the value of the profession and the demand of the profession. I think there's a lot of vision and mission casting that has to happen at the level of school leadership that might create a context in which teachers are more inclined to stay in a particular school.
Before we wrap up, I also wanted to cover student behavior with you. We've seen a lot of headlines and just media news articles recently about student behavior and how that's kind of driving this issue and the teacher shortage in general. So what about that? What are your thoughts there?
You know, one of my favorite books about student behavior, which is called Troublemakers, talks about students as canaries in the class, in the coal mine. And so the idea here is that when we see students responding in ways that might not be desirable to adults, they might be responding to a particular environmental stimulus that adults might be otherwise inured to. They might not be recognizing. And so I hope that we take this very seriously when we think about student behavior. I think our students have been through a tremendous amount, some of which might still be invisible to adults. And I hope that as we think, you know, about leaders creating contexts in which teachers can feel successful, connected, autonomous, that we're also thinking about the kinds of environments in which students feel belonging, success, you know, excitement about learning. And so I think there is a multi-pronged initiative probably available to us that's about connecting kids to learning, connecting kids to their teachers, connecting families to schools, inviting legitimate decision-making capacity among families and communities to schools. I hope that this conversation about student behavior is also a conversation about how can we meet student needs, perhaps more broadly than academic needs.
Thanks to Lauren Bales, Associate Professor in UD's School of Education, and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us. We explore efforts to build the pool of math teachers in the First Eight with one of the winners from this year's Delaware STEM Educator Awards. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The Delaware STEM Educator Awards annually celebrate K-12 educators that go above and beyond to teach and inspire students in STEM, a methodology that engages students around the subjects of science, technology, math, and engineering. Among the winners this year are the Math Marigolds, a team of math educators working to foster student interest in teaching math as a career. This week, I spoke with Brandywine High School math teacher David Maloney, who helped start the Math Marigolds, about his award-winning team and the importance of building the pool of math teachers in Delaware. First off, why did you and your colleagues decide to start Math Marigolds?
So basically, there's a huge math teacher shortage. And basically, it started off as we've been, even though the other math miracles, we all teach at different buildings across the state. We've all known each other because we attend statewide PD professional development together. And we've known each other for a very long time. And one of the people at the University of Delaware, Diana Roscoe, she was in charge at that time of the student teachers and was just interested in like, how do we build a program? Like, how do we get more people involved? And so we kind of just started a group and we were like, hey, let's try to figure like, what could we do? And at the time we didn't really know. So in the early stages, this was just a organic thing of a bunch of us on Zoom talking to each other about, hey, should we start a club in our each school, or should we just start interviewing kids? And it really just kind of started there.
Well, I was going to say, so what did you kind of wind up settling on, and how has it kind of developed? I mean, obviously you just want a STEM educator
Right.
award for the work you're doing. So what sets you guys apart? What has worked that's getting this kind of recognition?
Yeah. So basically, a little bit of backstory. There's that PD that I was talking about that we go to. We call it Leadership Coaching Lab. And it is a, we take teachers who all teach math, and we come together a couple times a year, usually about 4 or 5 times, and we plan together and we do math together. We talk about lessons together. We talk about how to engage students. And it's just positive. Like it's, I can't overemphasize the positiveness that happens at that particular group, that particular PD. As our group was on the Zooms and we were talking about how could we get some kids excited or maybe about maybe teaching math, Shelly said, why don't we bring them to Leadership Coaching Lab? And we kind of had this thought of like, could we do that? Could we bring students to a teacher PD? And how would we arrange that? How would we get like approval? How do we get transportation there? Like, and is it a field trip or whatever? And it just kind of started there. That first year, we only had a couple kids come and they all loved it. They were like, wow, this is kind of cool. We're like seeing all this positivity and all these teachers. They're really talking about how to reach kids and how to get better. So that's kind of where it started. So the five of us then started all bringing students, and we would bring kids who, like, and for myself, I had been interviewing kids, like, what do you like about math? Like, what's the best qualities of a math classroom? And then it kind of evolved to like, have you ever thought about being a math teacher? And so we got a couple kids who were like, yeah, you know what? I have thought about it. I think it would be neat. And so we bring these kids to this PD, and I'm at Brandywine High School, so we had to organize a field trip. Got to get the field trip approval. You gotta, I can't take them in my own car, so I got to get a transportation approval, and then we got to go through all. But we went through all the stuff, and then we get the kids there, and it sounds weird. Like, why would high school kids want to go to a teacher professional
Professional
development? But
development.
when they left, they were like, you know what? I was treated as an equal. Like these teachers in the room, when they randomly sorted us and were in groups, they wanted to know what I was thinking. And I'm like, absolutely, they wanted to know what you're thinking because they're good teachers who all want to know how to reach students the right way, And so it kind of evolved from there. So from the five of us bringing kids, now we have more teachers bringing kids, and it's really blown up. So instead of having like five kids at this PD, I think Jamila counted that we had about 80 kids last year, not all at one time, but like through the year, like 80 different kids had participated in it. And this year at our very first meeting, we had over 30. So it's growing, and we're kind of planting this seed of getting kids in high school considering teaching math. And I have some more personal success stories I can share with you later. But the idea of the name Math Marigold, where it transferred from this really long title of like building a more inclusive pathway to math education, which was this big long thing, to now we're called the Math Marigolds because the marigold flower, when you plant it next to other flowers, it helps other flowers grow. it's just one of those things where, people who have gardens and love flowers, they love planting marigolds because the other flowers flourish. So the idea was, well, these positive math teachers are math marigolds. So if we can get kids around them, we'll get them to grow. And then these students become the marigolds as well, where they're creating this positive energy. And it's just this huge thing of everybody's kind of bouncing off of each other. And it's become this bigger thing where hopefully we're inspiring more young people to get into education.
So is it a little bit of just a basic premise of pulling back the curtain a little bit and letting these kids see what it is to be a math teacher?
Exactly.
Which I guess kind of helps break down some of the hurdles to getting kids interested. I imagine one is kind of that trope that only some people are math people. Is that
Right.
like one of the things you're trying to break down a little bit?
Absolutely. One of the guidance counselors at my school, her name's Miss Susan Holman. She jokes with me all the time. She's like, we've got something like there's math teachers in the past that have, made kids afraid of math, just like you're saying. And then she's like, and then we got Mr. Maloney, who's taking kids with 1.75 GPAs, and they want to be math teachers now. So it's that whole thing of, yes, trying to like get it more inclusive and get people involved,
Is there also that other
Sure.
kind of situation where kids, particularly in high school, don't see the connection between math and, again, quote unquote, real life? I mean, is that also part of what you're trying to break down here too, that they see that there's a there for them learning math and then all passing that knowledge on?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Definitely. I'm a big believer that everybody can do math. And even though there's this, like you said, this fear and this scariness to it, what we're definitely trying to promote the, everybody can find some enjoyment in this, everybody can find some connection to this, and everybody can be successful in it. And so not just connecting it to real world examples and stuff, but also just getting kids to like math, and seeing the good sides of math, not just the scary parts,
And I imagine doing that is especially important when it comes to connecting girls and students of color to math. Because obviously, one of the goals you guys talk about, I think, is having math teachers who reflect the kids they're teaching, and these kids can see themselves in the teachers. Is that also kind of important to breaking down those barriers?
It is, but I can't do anything about it myself because I'm a white male, right? But yes, it is a part of, there's some truth that we want our staffs for the students to see people who look like them as their teachers. And so we do, as we were doing this project, it was one of our things that we had talked about in the beginning, was maybe targeting more minority students to build that. For a while, that was one of our focuses of, but then we said like, well, we're limiting ourselves, right? So we also need to like just take anybody who's interested in becoming a math teacher.
I understand one of the other areas you're focused on is teacher retention. So it's great to get new teachers, but you also want to kind of keep the good teachers you have in the classroom. Obviously, issues of pay and school climate are factors here, and that's stuff that state lawmakers are working on and state officials are working on. But what are some of the things that you guys are doing as a group to keep those good math teachers in the classroom and inspiring the next generation of teachers?
Well, I think it comes back to that PD I was talking about. When we get together, it's so like it just gets the juices flowing and gets you back inspired. When we have those times when we come together and we share ideas, and it's just refreshing to have that day where you just know going in you're going to have positive energy with these other teachers who are also math marigolds at their schools, and they're the star teachers or wherever. And then of course, you try to build not just the math marigold thing, but you try to build other programs within your school to try and help with the teacher retention. So this is a little off topic from the math marigold, but I think it's relevant to your question of like here at Brandywine High School, we have started a peer observation program. So we have teachers who volunteer to be observed, And so, my principal came to me and I'm like, absolutely, I'm an open door. Anybody can come in. Like, come on. And so teachers are taking time during their planning period to go visit other teachers and just see what's going on in the other rooms, because it's a profession where all too often we're alone in our rooms doing our own thing. Whereas, doctors talk to each other, lawyers talk to each other, other professions, you're in groups, you're working with other people. And for teaching, you can get very isolated sometimes where you're just in your room and you really don't know. You're like, oh, this Maloney guy got this STEM award or Teacher of the Year award. What is he doing? And they don't know what I'm doing because they're in their room while I'm in my room. And so my principal's been really good about saying, you know what, let's create this Google form and find our planning periods, our duty periods, and find ways to observe each other and get into each other's classrooms and learn from each other. I think that helps create a positive climate that has people talking to each other more. Like, for example, there was one time where an English teacher came into my classroom and he saw the way I was solving equations. And he was like, he came back to me afterwards, like, that was a different way than I ever remember being taught that when I was younger. And he's like, I think I'm going to try an English lesson where I do something similar to this. And he started talking about it. And, here it was, a math teacher and an English teacher brainstorming about a different lesson. And I think that's cool. I think that's really cool. But I think it speaks to when you're in a positive climate where you're talking to actually your other peers and talking about positive lessons, I think that helps create good teacher retention and a more positive climate.
Thanks to Brandywine High School math teacher David Maloney of the Math Marigolds for taking some time to join us on The Green this week. Up next, a look at a community program that engages high school students in philanthropic work. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Distributing grant money to nonprofits isn't something high school students normally learn about, let alone actually do. It's often not until they graduate college and enter the workforce that they have the opportunity to join an organization's board. But for more than 25 years, the Delaware Community Foundation's Youth Philanthropy Board has put high school students in charge of examining issues in their communities and ultimately deciding how to allocate thousands of dollars in funds to various programs that address them. This week, Delaware Public Media's Joey Rosari chats with Yolanda Rushton, Senior Program Officer with the Delaware Community Foundation, about the value of giving students a chance to help their communities through philanthropic work.
Yolanda, this program has been around for decades now, but before we get to the finer details of the Youth Philanthropy Board and how it works, can you give us some background on the program and why the Delaware Community Foundation originally decided to start it?
It's been around for 25 years. We were happy to celebrate that this year. And it's actually started from a fund holder. Her name was Phyllis Wynn. And in 1999, she's a retired educator. And she said that she wanted students in Newcastle County to be more involved in philanthropy. And so what better way to do that than to create this fund and this opportunity? After a few years, the DCF as a whole, as an organization, started to administer the funds, and we created the opportunity in Kent and Sussex because it just started in Newcastle, and then we expanded it to Kent and Sussex.
Can you speak more to the value in allowing high schoolers to distribute grants to community organizations and learn about the process of giving back at such a young age?
We've all learned over the years that no matter the age, I mean, I firmly believe this, that people can come into being community advocates and to learn more about how and why to give back. And so the opportunity was created. And so we said, you know what, high school students is a great way and a great entry point for folks to come into philanthropy. Why wait? Why wait until you're in college? Let's start that learning now so that they can get a grassroots level education on how to come into philanthropy and learn more about their communities and give back. Giving back doesn't have to only be through giving. It can be through volunteering as well. And so what's happened, what's been created from that is there's now these points where people can come in into the DCF. They can be within the YPB during high school years, graduate from high school. You can then get a scholarship. You go through college, and then you can come back to the DCF for another program that we have called the Next Gen.
So walk us through how the program works and how these high school students identify organizations to give back to and grant funds are decided.
Sure. So the first part is always recruitment. And recruitment starts in April. The program runs from October through May. And what at the end of it is when we have a grant ceremony, which I'll get to that. But in April, we start reaching out to schools around generally around spring break or so before they go out into their summer breaks. We try to reach out to them and say, you have an opening at your school. We can only take one student per high school because of the sheer amount of high schools that are available. And we don't want to make the boards too big. So it's one student per high school. Once a student graduates or they say, my caseload is too big, I'm not able to return, that vacancy is then filled by us reaching out to those schools for recruitment. Once a student comes on board, we teach them the very base level of what philanthropy means. And like I said before, it's not just with volunteering or giving back, it's learning more about communities, it's civic engagement, and we give them those learnings over the course of months that they're here with us. And they're the ones that are determining what the focus statement should be in that year. The boards are diverse, and diverse in terms of who's participating. Is it pub It's public school students, it's students at private schools, it's homeschool students, it's students going to more parochial schools, charter schools. So there's diversity not only in the schools, but of course in race, in lived experiences, and all of that determines what that focus statement would be. There are students over the years who have said, I have a lived experience, unfortunately, with gun violence. They have a discussion about that. And then there's another student one year who said, you know what, I have a learning disability. I think that we should focus on this. So it's always on issues that are important to them and their peers. And of course, nonprofits need to be able to respond to these applications that they're putting out there. So there is a discussion of, I hear you that this is an issue that's going on within your respective groups or within your own lived experience, but is this something that is currently available with nonprofits in our county that they can then respond to and get funding for their programs? So we do want to make sure that it's a focus area that nonprofits could respond to. So once the focus statement is chosen, and that's chosen in November, so we just decided ours for each county, an application is then created and then sent out in December. Nonprofits are able to respond from December 2nd through January 3rd. After January 3rd, the applications are assigned to each student within each county, right? And so there's a board in each county. So those respective boards get their applications assigned to them. The students are reading the applications. They're coming up with questions that they're going to meet with every single applicant that applied in February. So they read through the applications. They come up with their questions. February, they're meeting with their nonprofits, asking them very specific questions about their needs. What does their impact look like? Who benefits from their programs? And these are questions that they're determining on their own. And then once they have their meetings, they're then having a funding meeting in March. And that's a big debate in terms of who's getting funding, how much are we cutting, are we giving more to organizations? And so that's in March. And then April, we have a grant ceremony, which is a big celebration of these are the orgs that are getting funding. And then the students themselves are honored for participating in the board for 1, 2, 3 years. They can participate up to 3 years.
What are some recent examples of the kind of foundations or community organizations that the students are giving grant money to? And can you share some of those with us?
Absolutely. One is Down Syndrome Association. They receive funding for their athletic box program. And so one student in particular was really impressed with the organization and them creating opportunities for their communities to be athletic, to play in sports. Despite their own challenges, they said that these are opportunities that, you know, but for funding from the YPB, they wouldn't be able to participate. Another one is Edge for Tomorrow. They receive funding for their program that helps students with social media challenges. So the impact of social media, because that was something uniquely that was a focus statement in each county last year. Newcastle, Kent, and Sussex, no one met at the same time, but they all chose the impact of social media as a focus statement. And Edge for Tomorrow was one of those beneficiaries. Another one is the Harry Kay Foundation. They, of course, have their backpack program where they're allocating backpacks filled with food in Kent and Sussex County. And so those are some of the programs that we've supported.
And I read recently that a high school student who took part in a youth philanthropy board said that what drew her to it was the fact that you let a group of high schoolers choose what nonprofits get grants and which ones they think are doing the most work for them. Is that a common sentiment as far as why students choose to take part in the program?
Absolutely. They want to get back. They want to learn more. These are students that are high achieving students. This is not their first hurrah with respect to volunteering or getting into the community. They're already doing the work. They just want to learn more, and they want to be able to give back in unique ways. So yes, that is the sentiment across the board, that they want to know the back end piece of grant making and philanthropy in general, but it's also because they already have a love for their community.
So after finishing their time with the Youth Philanthropy Board, what kind of feedback have you received from students and maybe even their parents?
So there are a few quotes that I have directly from some of my students. They've sent me emails just to share more about their experience, to your point. And so one of them, I'm going to read verbatim, is "The experience has been life-changing. It has given me an opportunity to see how nonprofit organizations can impact the lives of our community and our state. I have learned a great deal, which has allowed me to utilize and develop my organizational, negotiating, listening, public speaking, and multitasking skills." Another board member says, "The board has been pivotal to me as a citizen and taught me the obligations I owe to my neighbors and youth in Wilmington. And I'm beyond grateful for the leadership and role you've played in helping me grow into a philanthropic community." And a parent said, "I would like to thank you for all that you've done for my son. These past two terms with the Youth Philanthropy Board have been life-changing for him. He is more confident, outspoken, and has become a better leader."
Thanks to Yolanda Rushton, Senior Program Officer with the Delaware Community Foundation, and our Joey Rosari for joining us on The Green this week. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where we examine the benefits of mindful birding. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. If you've ever found yourself captivated by a robin searching for worms in the grass, or paused to listen to the morning chorus of birds, you might have experienced the quiet magic of bird watching. For many, birding is more than just a chance to spot a feathered friend. It's a way to slow down, reduce stress, and reconnect with the natural world. Next week, the Delaware Ornithological Society is hosting The Birding Prescription, a talk about birding's impact on our health and well-being. And in this edition of Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny is joined by the Society's president, Joe Francis, to learn more about the benefits of mindful birding.
Let's start with just sort of a overview of what this upcoming talk is going to be about.
The talk is going to be a conversation between myself and, you know, through my perspectives as a physician that's done public health as well as internal medicine and geriatrics, and my clinical observations on exposure to nature. And Holly Merker, who is an amazing individual who was a lifelong birder, an expert birder who leads tours all over the country and is a certified art therapist who herself went through a period of poor health and found a lot of solace in birding and leveraged that to create something she calls ornithotherapy, which is using essentially experiences in nature, observing birds, as a way to promote mindfulness, to reduce stress, increase resilience and health. And the remarkable thing is, you know, we came to this from two very different perspectives, but the science is very compelling. And the last few years, there's been a lot of research on the importance of exposure to nature and time outdoors. If I can use the term awe, which may not be the easiest to define, but the whole concept that, you know, there are things happening in nature, in the universe, that are bigger than ourselves. And that's a way to sort of take us out of our everyday worries that cause stress and lead to poor health.
Well, let me ask about some of the ways that birding can help contribute to better mental health.
Absolutely. So, you know, the science is still evolving, but what I would say is that the impacts are partly on the biology. So we know that, you know, exposure to sunlight, to fresh air, you know, moderate exercise, which is the kind of exercise you get walking around in the woods or wherever you may be birding, those all promote health and well-being. We know from studies that have been done with volunteers that exposure to nature and time spending, birding or looking at other aspects of nature, reduce biomarkers of stress, like cortisol and inflammatory biomarkers. So there's some real physical effects happening here. And a lot of the ways we like to see folks consider bird watching is a form of a mindfulness activity. And so all the things that you do associate with mindfulness-based therapies, concentration, breathing, balance, motion, avoidance of distractions, we think those things can come into play in birding and, in fact, are very effective for being a successful birder. You know, it doesn't have to be an exotic species. Watching crows or blue jays and in the city, watching pigeons, not only can tell you something about how nature works, it gets you outside of yourself, and that whole process of mindfulness calms you down.
You know, one thing that stands out to me is that it seems very, very common sense. If you're feeling anxiety, if you're feeling stress, spend some time outside, spend some time doing these mindful things. But this is also backed up by serious research, right?
Absolutely. And it's complicated research to do. You know, it's easier to study a pill, you know, because you can randomize. Some people get a pill, some people get a control, like a placebo. This is harder to do the science in because, you know, there isn't the standard dose of nature. We all experience it differently. You know, there are many other things that are going on and influencing our lives. But again, it's sort of when you triangulate across all the sources of evidence, it's pointing out something which I'll say quite honestly, we've known for a long time. There's also some interesting research in the sphere of awe. And a woman whose book I just finished reading named Keltner, who talked about, you know, if you took healthy older people and you had them go out on, she calls these awe walks, but they were basically walks in nature. And the whole idea was you turn off your smartphone with one exception. You can take pictures of what you're seeing. And you just pay attention to what's around you. And what she found was that stress levels went down. But more importantly, people felt better about each other. And I feel like in the times we're living through today, particularly our experiences of the last 2 weeks, you know, we need activities that can reduce polarization. Beautiful thing about birding, you know, I got into birding because my father was a farmer, lived downstate. He was a hunter. Long before I became a birder, we spent lots of time outdoors and with many different types of people across the spectrum. But we could all agree on things that we loved, like nature, the outdoors. You know, those things were really important, and it created a bridging. And we need things like that more and more today.
Birding can also be pretty beneficial for the birds as well. Can you talk a little bit about that?
You need to know something before you love it. You need to love something before you decide to save it. And I think that awareness, Holly talks about this in terms of reciprocity. You know, you're getting something back from the birds. You want to give back to them in ways that might be very simple. You know, my own life, you know, I've reduced my footprint. Long ago, I lived in a 4,000 square foot home in another state. And I was like, Lordy, what do I need that for? I live in a 1,300 square foot apartment But the beauty of it is that I'm right outside of State Park. So I can walk outdoors and I'm immediately in nature. And I have more time to do it because I don't have to cut the grass or blow the leaves.
One thing that's really appealing about birding compared to a lot of other pastimes is it strikes me there are really no barriers to entry. There's no real cost to get started. It's something that you can do anywhere. How can people who are interested in starting this get started?
You're very right about the low bar to entry. You don't even need optical equipment. Just going outdoors, using your eyes and your ears, there's a lot that you can take in without specialized equipment. I tell people these days we're living in the golden age of optics because you can get, you know, starter pairs of binoculars, for instance, for under $100. And recently we purchased in DOS a bunch of these binoculars for children because we're trying to get children started. And it's the whole idea is just get people outdoors and allow the natural connections and fascination with the outdoors to take place. I suggest spend some time with other people that are experienced. Birding has a lot of skills underneath it. And I mean, I'm still learning how to be a better birder. And there are lots of field trips that are available. The DOS website, all of our field trips, all of our meetings are open to the entire public. The Sussex Bird Club similarly does a lot of great stuff, had field trips and the Hawk Watch at Cape Henlopen that allows me to segue. All of our state parks, if you go to the website, you can actually search under bird watching and you'll find that virtually every state park now hosts a bird walk, often once a month. And it's usually a volunteer from DOS or the Sussex Bird Club or other groups. Basically, you can find a bird walk happening within the next few weeks, wherever you live, with whatever county in Delaware.
Finally, I was reading an article by Holly Merker, your speaker, and she said something that really sticks with me. I've been sort of reflecting on it as I'm getting ready for this interview. Birds are there for us when we need them. And I was wondering if you could just, to wrap up, reflect on that in your experience as a birder.
Well, this gets very personal, but, you know, like everyone, you know, we have down times in our life. And there were some stressful periods in my own life where there was great solace to be had in going outdoors. And I took a new job back in the early 90s. There were many challenges. And I just felt like after a few weeks, overwhelmed by the challenges. And at the end of the day, it was like, I can't continue doing this. I literally just got in my car and I drove. And I had no idea where I was going to go. And just by chance, I ended up in an area in rural Arkansas. I was living in Tennessee at the time, near a wildlife refuge, a state wildlife refuge. Just decided to find a hotel. And I spent the next day birding the refuge. And it was like someone did a power wash on my brain. All the things, the ruminative thoughts, the self-doubt, you know, these cycles of worry was broken. And I came back again with this sort of, you know, this mental washing completely refreshed me. You know, the birds are there, and it doesn't matter what birds there are. You know, we love times like migration when there's a great variety of birds. We love to chase after rare species. But even if those are not there, you know, go to your local pond and stare at the ducks. You'll learn a lot.
Thanks to Delaware Ornithological Society President Joe Francis and R. Martin Matheny for enlightening us this week. The Delaware Ornithological Society's talk about birding's impact on our health and well-being, the birding prescription, is this Wednesday, November 20th, from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Ashland Nature Center in Hokesson. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And Remember the Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Joey Urizarry and Martin Matheny, along with our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernting. Thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.